Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you through the generous support of the Icon Research Center at the University of Warwick in UK. This is episode 17, where we talk about gender in organizations. Our reading for this episode is Some Effects of Proportions on Group Life by Rosabeth Moss Cantor. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. And this is Ralph Soule. I'm coming to you from Albuquerque, New Mexico, a mere 1,708 meters above sea level.
This is Pedro coming to you from Brasilia, Brazil's capital.
And this is Deborah Brewis coming to you from London in the United Kingdom.
Hello, everyone. As you might have noticed, we have a special guest on this episode, Deborah. So I'll give you a brief introduction about her. Deborah was a colleague at Warwick. She finished her PhD there, and now she is a lecturer in organizational behavior at Kingston University. Deborah has a background studying issues related to organization, identity, inequality, and diversity. If I'm not mistaken, she did her PhD about diverse practitioners. And she has also, I would say, an interest and great experience in the arts. And she has collaborated with a number of artists and different people to try to engage public audiences on research. Was that correct, Deborah?
Yes, brilliant. Thank you very much. Shall I say a few words to introduce the text?
Yes, would you please?
Yeah, that'd be great.
So the paper that we're discussing today is Rosabeth Moss Cantor's paper called Some Effects on the Proportions of Group Life, Skewed Sex Ratios and Responses to Token Women. And this is an aspect of her work on a number of issues related to gender in organisations from 1977. Her larger work is her most well-known, arguably, Men and Women of the Corporation. And she speaks to a number of issues in that book that relate to gender equality, such as horizontal and vertical segregation of work within organisations, the different roles that women and men play in organising, and factors that contribute to structuring interactions between women and men and to reinforcing the status quo of sex distribution. So the paper that we read to prepare for today features as one chapter in that book. In it, Cantor is considering how interactions between members of particular organisational groups are affected by the relative numbers of people from differing social groups. So she focuses on interactions in what she calls skewed groups. So that is groups where there's a high proportion of people from one social group and a very small number or just one or two people from another social group, which she calls tokens. And so Cantor looks at the interactions in a sales team where there are far fewer women than men. And what she's doing is attempting to tease out the effects that the skewed composition of the group has. And I wanted to say thank you for inviting me to join in the discussion today, because my research relates to, if you like, the modern end of these discussions. And in particular, the discourses of, you know, diversity and inclusion. Mm-hmm. So I found it really interesting to go back and read this, in some ways, classic text, but really from not so long ago, that is still talking to some of the issues that we're facing today, but also focuses us in on the very different ways that we're thinking about some of these concepts now around sex and gender, and even the different interpretations we've had of equality and the strategies for addressing equality within the time frame between when the text was written and now.
So, Deborah, that will be interesting to hear as we go through the text, you updating us on the different ways that people think and write about these kind of issues today. And I want to say I really appreciate you suggesting this text, because as a male of the species, it's easy for me to say, well, we've got all this equality now and women are, you know, representative higher numbers in the workforce, and we've opened up these various occupations to them, and particularly in the military, they've just recently opened up many formerly closed occupations to women. it's easy to say, well, you know, we're past all that stuff now. And in fact, I think it's important that we recognize how hard it is for people in any kind of skewed group, you know, women or not, but basically, and how far, even though we've come far, it's these kinds of issues persist over time, and we may not even really think about them. I know I didn't think about a lot of them, and I will point out during the text some areas where I really had some eye-opening moments about things that I had seen in my work life that I really had not considered, and therefore that this has been very beneficial. So thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. That was great. Great introduction. And as Rob said, I think you bring a lot of interesting elements to the discussion, given your background and your research. I just want to start by saying that one of the things that I found interesting on this text is, in a way, although it's based on a specific research about men and women in a large industrial corporation, in a way, she's trying to make a case for different kinds of situations in which we have someone from a different social background that joins a group. So you could, in a way, think that pretty much applies to diversity in general. You can think about race, you can think about sexual minorities. So I think that when I started reading, that was the first thing that came to mind. You know, that was an interesting effort to have like a larger framework to think about those things. But as I read the paper, I started to think that actually it seems the things that she's saying seems very specific to gender. So I think I was a bit torn on those issues. And I would be curious to know what you, Deborah, thought about that.
I thought the same kind of thing. So basically, thinking about the way she wrote the article, I wish she hadn't waited so long to bring that up. It's many, many pages into the paper where you finally see that she's talking about groups in general, because she spends a lot of time explaining, which I realize in hindsight is necessary, but she spends a lot of time up front explaining about group distribution and the different types, and I didn't get a kind of really good overview of where the paper was going, so it takes a while to warm up. So if the listeners are worried about that, keep going, you know, past the first 10 or 15 pages. It's worth it. And then I also was a little worried because she makes a statement early in the text about these kinds of differences should apply to other groups, but she doesn't give any data. So as a social scientist, I'm looking at it and saying, okay, how can you say that? And then the data comes later. So I think she does have good data for it, but I think she makes kind of a weak intro to that or initially. So I also found that a little less than satisfying initially.
I had similar reactions to both of you. I initially found myself writing notes in the margins of the paper saying, is this just a logical argument, or is empirical data coming later? But also,
yes,
yeah. Also, as Pedro was saying, I found myself questioning to what extent these findings are generalizable to other groups, because she starts making a case for it very early on.
Yes, exactly.
And perhaps some things are, particularly I felt around the issue of visibility. But when she was talking about polarization of difference, so the idea that having a token enter a group with their difference means that the group reacts in a way that, what she says, underlines or reinforces their dominant culture, almost as if the difference is a threat. I could see that not being able to be generalized so much in other cases. Mm-hmm. So I had a similar pattern of thought, I think.
Okay. I said that, but now I think I'm going to take it back a bit, because it just occurred to me. No, because I was just wondering that, in a way, she's trying to frame the paper in a very general sociological issue about groups, and she's quoting Simo and everything. So I wonder, when she was writing those things, maybe gender inequality as a topic per se was not perceived in social sciences to be worthy of attention, maybe, so she had to, in a way, package it around something else. It was just, I don't know what.
That's a good point.
Yeah,
it's hard to know.
Almost like it's a legitimacy thing, you know, like you have to put some cover of something general.
Yes.
I felt that she was certainly reacting to something by framing the paper in this way. The something to me seemed, in the way that she was writing about the topic, was the explanations that people often go to for why women can't enter organizations. So she mentions at one point the stereotype of women fearing success.
Yes.
Yes.
Or women are presumed to turn against other women who try to enter organizations. So that was a strong reaction in the text, and that was made explicit.
Yes. I think that was one of the things that was most powerful for me in the text, because, and I think she uses that sentence, is that those explanations usually take the consequence for the cause.
So one of the things that I would like to, I just want to digress a bit, because I got something out of this, and maybe it could have been better developed in the paper, and so there you have it. But she talks about a Sumalian approach, but she only sums it up in about a sentence or so. And she talked about how in the 1950s he argued persuasively that numerical, you know, modifications or absolute numbers affect qualitative transformations in group interaction. So she does talk about that, but I actually went and looked at something that he wrote in 1902, because I could find it on the web. It's called The Number of Members as Determining the Sociological Form of the Group. And it was published in the American Journal of Sociology in 1902. And in that article, it's an interesting article, but in the article, he made the argument that the decisive factor is that numerical equality constitutes the form principle of the division, although it never decides alone, but merely plays a role. And then he goes on to say, size is highly significant for the group. And that means, when he says size, he's talking about the size of the representation of the members of the group. And it was helpful for me to go back and look at what he had written, because it helped me see a little bit more about the theoretical framework that Cantor was using.
But that is great. I honestly didn't know enough about Zeman, so thank you for that.
Well, he's a very interesting character too, because he basically got his PhD, but never got a paid lecturing position until just before his death. And he did lots of lecturing and lots of writing and publishing, but just because at that time in Germany, I believe that's where he was living, there were not that many university positions. He basically went a large fraction of his very prolific writing career without being a paid university lecturer. He actually gave lectures. There's a name for this, and maybe Deborah knows it better than I do, but there, you would give lectures and the students would pay you. The university wasn't paying you, and I don't know whether what you lectured on was sponsored by the university or however. But one thing I think that would help us guide us through the text is the text is in sections, and she's got the introductory section. I think we've talked about this when she talks about groups, types, and sets the very clear framework for talking about skewed groups and what they are. And that section isn't an actual label, but I guess you could consider it the introduction. And then the next section is the field study, where she talks about the study. Then she goes into her theoretical framework that talks about the work of George Simmel. And then she gets into what I consider the really interesting parts of the study, where she talks about the performance pressures on the tokens and how they respond, the boundary heightening, which we can talk about when we get to what that means and what the consequences are. And then role entrapment, which is something I'd never seen before, but I thought very interesting the way she described it and the responses of the of the tokens.
Yeah. I just want to clarify one thing. She starts the framework by giving three mechanisms, we can call them, and she talks about visibility, polarization, and assimilation. And then she links those to these three things that Ralph just mentioned, which was the performance pressure, the boundary heightening, and the role entrapment, which we can just call it stereotypes. And then what I found interesting, and then you can see the richness of her data, that she's not only presents these structural characteristics, but also is able to tease out how do they impact the daily work of women in these situations, and how do they respond to that as well.
Yes, and that's where I thought, to me, the study comes alive, because now she's talking about her data and she's grounding her statements in the data and the things she's observed. So I find that much more satisfying as a scholar to see why is she coming to these sort of general conclusions, and that she was actually able to connect it to the data. Before we go any further, I would like to just go over briefly what she talks about, what a skewed group is, because I think that's important for the listeners. So she says, skewed groups are those in which there is a large preponderance of one type over another, and she says up to 85 to 15 ratio. And the numerically dominant types also control the group and its culture in enough ways to be labeled dominance. And she uses that term throughout the rest of the paper. And then unless people get concerned or irritated by the use of the word token. I mean, she uses that in a very particular social science sense. And so she doesn't mean it, I believe, as a pejorative term. She says the few of another type in a skewed group can appropriately be called tokens because they are often treated, and this is important, as representatives of their category and as symbols rather than individuals.
Yes. And I would just add that I think this idea of tokens come from also, I can't remember the author, but I think it existed already, that it is kind of a proof that that group's in a way has some diversity. And I think that happened, you know, I think someone that was studying universities in the past and how universities in the south part of the US, actually, Ralph, would hire black people in a way, like very few of them, but just to say that they were integrated when the pressure started, you know, to change race dynamics in academia. So I think that's the idea of token as well. It's almost like this card that you can say, oh, we are, you know, bringing diversity here, which would be interesting to hear Deborah's ideas on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I was really struck by the use of token in this, particularly in that way that it does relate to how a person acts as a representative for a whole group or is perceived to be a representative. It made me think of more recent work by Sarah Ahmed, and others have also talked a little bit about it, where tokens in organizations not only are made representatives of their social group to promote equality, even if there's only one or two of them.
Yeah, I think the interesting part of that both of you have pointed out is if you're congratulating yourself that you're open-minded and diverse because you have one or two members of the token group, there's lots more to it. And that's one of the things that Cantor talks about in the implications, and I won't get to that, you know, too early. Mm-hmm. But that kind of opened my eyes up, because I thought, wow, there's a lot of these performance pressures, actually more like tremendous performance pressures and group representation pressures or role entrapment that Cantor writes about on these members of the group. And I wonder if these so many organizations that bring in token representation are thinking about that extra support that they need. And even so, when I read Cantor, it looks like, well, many cases that extra support actually doesn't help, or it continues to heighten the boundary differences. So in some ways I thought, gosh, that's almost a no-win situation.
Yeah, absolutely.
True. I just want to, since you mentioned the performance pressure, I thought that we could start digging in a bit more in the mechanisms. So if I understood correctly, if we take that tokens are in a way, I like the way she says it, hyphenate individuals, in which they are always seen as symbols of categories. And also, you think of an engineer, but if you have a woman who is an engineer, like in a complex product development organization as the one I studied, you would have a female engineer. Or if you are in a university department that majorly you have white men that are professors, you'd have like a black woman professor. And also that's this idea that the person automatically is seen as a category more than an individual. So she talks about on how this creates a kind of hyper visibility to this individual. And that has a lot of consequences, because of course if you are so in the foreground, it's hard in a way to...
Yeah, I was just thinking as you were talking there, Pedro, that this hyphenated status, it does bring these extra performance pressures through the visibility.
Yeah.
But it also, I mean, Cantor refers to this hyphenatedness as being as though the individual has a master status. They have a social marker that dominates.
Yes, yes. Representative of the entire group.
Absolutely.
Yes. fact, I was in a diversity class where somebody was talking about they were in some group. She was a black female, and it was some kind of technical group or something where she was the only black female. And she wasn't in our group. We weren't doing this in our group, but she was talking about how people would often turn to her and say, you know, Jane, so give us the black woman's perspective. You know, as if Jane could articulate and channel what every black woman was thinking in this kind of circumstance. And I think she might have said that she was offended at that, but she had a very nice and classy response, and she just said, "I can't speak for all black women. I'm not a representative of the class. I can tell you what I think, and you know that is this." So I thought it was a very nice but clear and straightforward response to somebody putting her on the spot and saying, "Well, yeah, so you're like, tell us what all black women think." Goodness gracious!
Yeah, that sounds like a very generous response to a placing of undue burden on that one individual, where really members of dominant groups should be, you know, educating themselves about things, isn't it, rather than asking one person to speak. But this idea of, I just wanted to come back to this idea of master status, because I think it does speak to the idea of symbolism and representing a group.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the way that Cantor uses it is also to say that when your difference marks you out in a group, that social marker becomes dominant over anything else that you do, really. So it becomes difficult to have your competence recognized. Right. But also she was talking about these cases of mistaken identity, mm-hmm. I think she says, where token women would enter a male space but be mistaken for secretaries or assistants or even wives or girlfriends, which was really interesting. And that got me thinking about this idea of generalizability, which we started with, as to would this be the same, for example, if we had token males in certain groups. And she does actually get to talk about this like right at the end of the article, where she talks about male nurses. And I was also thinking about male teachers.
Well, and I would say probably not, right? Because more occupations are open to men than women, or at least in this time, and maybe still to a large extent today. So it's not that hard for people to see men in sort of these different roles, because they were dominating in them. But she does give a good example, I should say, and she gives a good example in the male nurse case. It probably doesn't cut the same way, Deborah. I agree with you, particularly because, so the term she gives to that, women salespeople being viewed as secretaries, right? She calls that status leveling, which I thought was a very interesting, you know, way to describe that or title that. And she did say much later in the text that in the case of male nurses, they were oftentimes referred to as doctor.
Mm, yeah.
Because people expected if a man was in the room in some medical situation, he must be the doctor.
Because the master status is a privileged identity.
Yes, yes. But I think it doesn't. So what's interesting, but she said, and I think she points this out, that in that, you know, case, the man is elevated, you know, so it's more like status elevation. And I think you are right when it comes to status leveling, where they're lowered in status. You probably don't see that as much with men as you do with women.
No, I mean, she did make some comments at the end of the text, which I found interesting, to do with how men do suffer in the way that they are called on to appropriately perform their masculinity, you know, to be a man, even as the token man among women. So they do suffer disadvantage in some ways by being in a skewed group.
Yes, and so I can give you some examples of that. So, because I've actually had that experience a couple of times, it's very eye opening. So, when I was the commanding officer of a Navy facility, there's a professional organization for women that they wanted to start, and it's something like Women in Government Service or something like that. And they came to me and they said, "We wanted to start this group." And I said, "Great idea." And they said, "And you know, you can be a member." And I thought, "Okay, that's great." So I came to the meetings, and I, first of all, I noticed, number one, there wasn't much I could contribute to the meeting, because they were talking about issues that were largely related to them. So I was having to learn how to reposition or put myself in sort of a different context. And then they gave out as meeting favors, or I'm not sure what you call them, right? But gifts to people who show up and register for the meeting. They gave out these little envelopes that contained nail files and other kinds of implements for grooming. And you know, not many of these things could relate to me except nail files, because I don't like having rough fingernails and scratching things up. So I do use those. And so I said, oh, this is wonderful. You know, I don't get enough of these things. And, you know, I think emery board is what we call it in the States, but you know, it's a way to file your nails. And so here I am, the sort of the token male, because this was something I was probably, it was probably 90-10 or 95-5. There's only one other male in there, myself. But I thought it was very interesting to kind of be in that position where you are the, maybe not the outsider, but the token. And so that was, I didn't think about those kinds of things that are in the article, but I had this kind of eye-opening experience and, that's why that stuff was going on. But they were very nice.
Okay. This makes me think actually something in a way related to the policy implications of the paper in a way, because from what we learn, I think the main position here is for affirmative actions and bringing a larger number of women to have change in gender dynamics at work. But what you're saying in a way is almost like the role of allies for any kind of change, in this case gender change, you know, which are not necessarily, they are not that group, but they might be pro changes towards that direction, in which, you know, Cantor doesn't discuss so much here. So at least that was what came to mind. But I wanted to go back on the theme of performance pressure, because another thing that I found very interesting that she says that in the experience of the saleswoman, they report that usually when they would go to talk to clients and everything, they would be remembered by their physical appearance much more than technical abilities many times, you know. And to go back to that thing, yes, that Deborah was discussing on how does this can relate to different kinds of diversity, I think it's very specific because it has to do with the specific ideas and stereotypes and general, I would say, assumptions that we have about women and men. Because, for instance, I think that I was in the Olympics recently and I was following up the coverage, and you know, there was a lot of discussion about the way women were groomed, or if they were in, I remember regarding the beach volley, there was a lot of things talking about a woman was wearing like a kind of a burkini, I think, not really a burkini, but she was much more covered than the others, and the whole thing was about that, not how well she played. And I remember also when the last president, which was now impeached in Brazil, who was a woman, when she had, you know, she took office 2 years ago, everyone in the social media was talking about whether her choice of the dress was good or bad and this and that for the president. I think I never heard anyone talking about a male president if he, the tie or the whatever, the suit was a good pick, you know.
I think that's a very good point, Pedro. I've often thought that's just a crazy performance pressure that we put on women in almost any role, this idea that about their grooming is considered a much bigger feature to notice or comment on or pay attention mm-hmm. to, as opposed to their performance. And I've often thought, not only is that really unfair, you know, to put all that extra pressure on them about the color of the dress or the style or, you know, those kinds of things, or the amount of makeup mm-hmm. they wear, but this idea that it's also putting them in this category of, you know, these are the things we're going to pay attention to, as opposed to what you do as an individual. So I find that very frustrating. And I think, you know, most the women who are in those positions, I find it just amazing how well they deal with stuff like that.
Yeah, there's a nice anecdote about Margaret Thatcher, isn't there, that she supposedly always chose to dress in a kind of uniform to try and deflect conversations or just sort of mm-hmm. discussion about what she was wearing. So, you know, jokes were made later about it, but apparently that was a strategic move.
Interesting. Well, so speaking of dress, I'm a retired naval officer, and the uniforms that we wore during my time in the service were predominantly khaki-colored and occasionally white for dress occasions, and then navy blue, which most people would have difficulty distinguishing from black. And so now that I'm retired from the Navy, I like to wear many different colors. And so it basically takes people aback, particularly my associates who I used to work with. When they see me come in, because I have pink and salmon colored pants, which I love to wear, and very bright shirts. And I like to wear colorful hats as well. And I was in the store in Albuquerque, where actually they tell me colorful dress is encouraged. And this salesperson, she was crossing in front of me, and I thought maybe about 2 meters in front of me. And I thought, well, I'll pause to let her go, you know, do her thing. And she stopped, and she stared at me, and said, you know, that's an amazing outfit, you know. And so I'm not quite sure what I never. So I just say, well, thank you for noticing those kind of things. So it's funny when you sort of step out of those kind of bland colors for a man, that sort of uniform. When Deborah talked about uniform, you know, I think I don't like to wear the same colors every day. In fact, after I retired, it was about mm-hmm. 2 years after, and I looked at my closet and I saw khaki, blue, khaki, blue, khaki, khaki, blue, khaki, blue. And I thought, why am I doing this? I could do anything I want. So I'll sometimes come to conferences, and you may remember this, Peter, from when I went to the OLKC. Yes. I had a nice red hat, you know, and very colorful clothes. And my wife will sometimes say, Don't you need to turn it down a little bit, you know, because aren't you, you know, worried about what people think? And I said, no, I want them to think I dress colorfully and I'm an individual. I think that's a good thing. So I think that's, I have some sense of those pressures that, you know, or when you violate the expectation, what it does to people.
Ralph, you've just brought up the concept of individualism through dress. And I think the assertion of individualism through clothes, through fashion, through sort of playing with symbols, be really sort of pleasurable and important. But I think something interesting, sort of bringing us back to the text that Cantor is talking about, is that women in the context she's talking about weren't allowed to be individuals, and that they were role cast or typecast, if you like.
No.
So I just thought it linked nicely to the roles that she was talking about. Right. So in mm-hmm. paying so much attention to how they dress, women attempting to manage the roles that they're being placed in. So she talks about the kind of psychoanalytical categories of kind of Madonna and whore. So she talks about the mother, the seductress, and then the pet and the Iron Maiden.
Oh, yeah, that was spooky mm-hmm. reading about. Yeah, well, and particularly the one about the pet, because when I looked at that, I saw, okay, so you would think, so it might be thought that, okay, so if a man or the sort of the dominant, let's just say the dominant, stands up for or tries to shield the token, you know, that would be a good thing. And then she describes how it's actually in many ways counterproductive. And so I thought, wow, that's very interesting. What I've seen many times where people try to stand up, and I've done it sometimes myself, is actually fits them, you know, forces them into that role from which it's very difficult to escape. So I think that's a really important mm-hmm. observation that I think that kind of runs throughout these pressures, is that these roles that get placed into don't allow them to be individuals and don't allow for that nuance that you would actually expect in individual behavior and character and dress mm-hmm. and that sort of thing.
I just wanted to give the background just to say that we are now talking about role entrapment, which is exactly this idea that, you know, distorting the characteristics of the token to fit pre-existing generalizations or stereotypes about those things. And in this case, it's woman. Right. And she talks about, just so the readers can understand, the role of the mother, the seductress, or you can call a whore, you know, this is a hypersexual role. And the pet, which could associate, you know, like a younger sibling, and the Iron Maiden, I think the example of Margaret Thatcher is perfect to fit here, which is exactly this problem in which, in order to be assimilated, there are specific, I would say, boxes that women have to fulfill because those are expectations.
I think that's really helpful, yeah. I mean, the idea of roles, I think, speaks to how women are made legible. They're made understandable as minorities in a particular group. So, it's, you know, we can understand you through these lenses, but these are the only lenses you're going to get.
Yeah, I really like the way you say that, made understandable.
Yeah.
So, you know, through these lenses, because and it is a very, seems like a very restricted set of lenses, right? So, and then I think we would all recognize that there's quite a bit more diversity in human behavior and characteristics and those sorts of things. So what a straitjacket that must be. I've often noticed, and I find it terribly irritating and frustrating, that women who exhibit very similar qualities to what are considered praiseworthy in men, and Cantor talks about this, so it's kind of aggressiveness and self-promotion and high standards. When a woman does it, because it doesn't fit, like Deborah was talking about, these lenses or that, you know, people can understand them through, it's considered abnormal, you know. And then, of course, we have all these, and I won't go through them, but all these kind of pejorative adjectives. And I think Iron Maiden and the Madonna are a couple of good examples of that. But we have these and other negative statements you make about people when if a male or the one of the dominants, so, you know, in this case, we're talking about male and female, but if one of the dominants was doing it, people wouldn't say anything, or they'd actually think it was praiseworthy.
The other thing...
Go ahead, Pedro.
Oh, just a quick thing. I was just going to say that what I like, however, in the discussion that Cantor puts forward is that she also shows how inviting these roles can be, because it gives a person somehow access. You know, it's really hard to try to fight a battle and to don't fit twice, if you will, because you don't fit because you're already in a minority and you don't fit what is expected from you. So I know I have always thought about diversity, and I consider myself, you know, someone that intermeshed different kind of, you know, diversity categories. And I think that many times I have put up with the role that was expected because it was just much easier. And from that on, you know, you can try to assert your own value.
Yeah, absolutely. I found it interesting to read her descriptions of the roles and the responses to the roles that she says that often acceptance is often the best response for people put in this position, because it made me reflect on perhaps I've responded to being in that position before, and I was trying to think, well, which one was I treated as?
That's
in
interesting.
Situations, and you know. Because my initial thought when reading this text and any text, and I think it's similar for you too, is to think there must be more complexity here. It can't be that, you know, where are the blurred lines between these different categories? But actually, as I was reading through them, I thought, actually, no, quite often I have been treated as a pet.
Wow.
In particular situations, as the kind, and it's sometimes to do with my stature, I think, because I'm quite a small woman and quite kind of lively and bouncy of personality.
Well, right, and that's an interesting feature that Cantor writes about, is that, you know, a response to role entrapment, right? That it's, you know, people who do get entrapped by the roles have these kinds of responses. So I imagine that was a very interesting reflective experience for you, looking back and trying to think about that those responses.
Yeah, absolutely.
So one of the things I wanted to mention from the prior section, when she talks about the performance pressures, she basically says there are two different kinds of responses, or two different responses that tokens take in response to the performance pressures. And the one is, I think, the one we've seen in many different circumstances, and that's the overachievement, you know, basically trying to outperform everybody. And there's these multiple reasons, right? Because, you know, your average achievement isn't recognized, or it tends to be undervalued. I mean, there's lots of reasons behind that. The other one I thought was really interesting, and it made me think a lot, was this idea of limiting visibility. And I thought that was fascinating, this because I've actually seen that before, and the light bulb came on. So I had I had a naval officer who was working with me, and she was really, really good at what she did. And I felt, I wasn't paying attention at the time about whether she was overperforming or not, but she was really good at what she did and very thoughtful. And I wanted to praise her. So I called her up in front of a room full of people and had her stand up in the room full of people with me to as I was praising her, like I would have done with a male. Mm-hmm. And you could just tell I embarrassed the heck out of her. And she was very reluctant to come up. And at the time, I thought, well, this is a sort of a female characteristic. But I did ask her about it later. And she says, I don't like that kind of attention. And that, so I agreed, all right, I won't do that to you again. I still like to praise you, but I won't make you walk up in front of the room and have everybody staring at you. I can see how that would be uncomfortable. And that really opened my eyes. And another one I think is a really important observation. This one was much more eye-opening. So we had a situation where we were in the ship was in an environment where there were civilian workers not assigned to the ship that were sexually harassing women in my department. And I got a little bit of notice of this, and I'll keep it very short. But at the very end, I told the women, I said, look, you need to report this to me. And I had a good enough relationship with them where they said, no, we don't. And I said, well, why would you choose not to report this? Because I need to go after these people. And several of them said, because it's not worth the trouble. In many cases, we'll just handle it at our level. If we report everything to you, then everything becomes this huge deal. And it detracts from our performance, and we become special objects of observation, and we don't want that. And so in the Navy, it's not just my preference, right? If you know these kinds of things are going on and you don't report them as a senior leader, you can get fired. And so what I told him was, I said, all right, use your judgment, but I would really appreciate it if it's something that you think is serious or you would complain to somebody else about, you come talk to me about it first. Because I have certain expectations for my performance as well, and I can't just ignore these things. But okay, if that's the way you want to manage it, go ahead. And so that was, I think, a manifestation of this desire to limit visibility and just manage these things.
I really like that part as well, because I think it in a way reflects a lot of both experience that I had as researcher or at work. And actually, stories from friends, as sociologists, social sciences, I would say, we always, I think, think through what we see around us. And I want to share a quick anecdote, which I think is less extreme than the Navy case. I have a friend, Stefania, if she's listening to us, that works in London in normal office, white collar related work, and she does data analytics, which is related to computer science and all that, which is still quite male environment, I would say. And she was telling me about her performance appraisal, and she was asked to complete a series of questions about how she would rate herself. What does she do on a daily basis? What does she think it's a good achievement she has done in the past month? So on and so forth. And when she showed it to her boss, which was a woman, her boss showed it to her, one from a male colleague, and she explained that, the way my friend phrased it, or the sentence, I think it was something like, oh, I help with blah, blah. I assist with blah, blah.
Oh, yeah. And I can see what this is going.
The male colleagues have always written, I did.
Right.
And the female showed it to her in a way almost like, she could write whatever she wants, but just to show the difference in the way, if she took as face value what she was reporting, she would, of course, I would say, rate her at a lower scale because of things that she was reporting. But of course, she knew enough about her daily work to evaluate that was actually the one leading most of those projects. Just a point that is still, I think, very, very, very ingrained in the way that work dynamics play out.
Yeah, I think Pedro's anecdote is interesting because it brings us back to, I think, something that Ralph may have alluded to earlier to do with perceptions of male behaviors or female behaviors, or what we would categorize as being masculine behaviors and feminine behaviors, and how they're perceived when attached to a woman's body. So women are used to behaving or are socialized perhaps to behave in particular ways, and so if they then behave or speak ways that are perceived to be more masculine, there's a kind of dissonance there. That I think, Cantor talks about is difficult to accept. But then also, in conjunction with this, feminine ways of behaving don't have the legitimacy that masculine ways of behaving do. So there's a kind of catch-22 that women can find themselves in. And Cantor kind of alludes to it in her text, but I think, you know, similar things are true today.
Yeah, that strikes me as so unfair about those, that role entrapment. Although you would, there are situations where, you know, you talk about the role entrapment and the way women respond. And in one example is sort of a, I didn't see this often in the military, but sort of flirty, coquettish, you know, kind of behavior. And in fact, that, as Deborah was saying, that could already be part of their natural personality. That it, so it wasn't purely just a response, but you know, maybe they got enough positive feedback from that that they accentuated or just continued to do it. But I was talking to a peer of mine from another ship, and he said that he had a woman who was behaving that way in the nuclear reactor control room. So he had to pull her aside and say, that's not acceptable. You know, you need to toughen up and, you know, probably assume these kind of male kind of characteristics or this level of formality, because you can't behave that way in this particular role. And I don't believe that's just limited to women, because in my case, I had a male who was, had a bubbly, you know, fun personality. He was an easy person to get to know and easy, very, you know, very easygoing. And he was behaving that way in the control room. And I pulled him aside and said, you need to stop that. You need to toughen up and be much more formal and strict, because this is not a club down there. And you have to be in charge and give direction. So I just thought it was interesting that sometimes it really is the role in the situation that dictates the behavior. And you could certainly make the argument that the existing stereotype of how someone should function in that role is male-centric or dominant-centric, but I thought it was a good example of how men and women, or dominants and tokens, can both run afoul of the expected behavior.
Yeah, but if I may, I think the anecdote is great and sheds light on something. I mean, I don't know what the words that you use in the situation and so on and so forth, but let's imagine, I think in certain circumstances, pulling aside a man and telling that you have to be more formal, so on and so forth, wouldn't be read as, it's just something that you have to do. But in the case of the woman, not necessarily you, Ralph, but in other situations could be read that, oh, this doesn't happen because you are a woman.
Yes.
You know, it's not just because it's something that you failed to do, as anyone can, but it's because of woman that you didn't do that. And I think that brings us to the third, I would say, mechanism that Cantor talks about, which is boundary heightening.
Yes.
In a way that when you have the token presence in that situation, it almost increases the barriers, you know, because there is the idea that they are threatening this commonality that existed in that group. So the dominant tend to exaggerate that trace that they have, you know, in the face of the token's difference.
I agree with you, Pedro, that the boundary heightening, I didn't really understand the nature of that, you know, what she was describing. And essentially, the way I understand boundary heightening is the tokens are trying to assimilate, there's all these behaviors and forces that actually restrict them further and make the boundaries even greater or thicker or the fences higher, whichever way you would like to look at that. And that it's the role of the dominance, you know, that accentuate their behavior that tends to cause these kinds of boundary stiffenings or heightenings, which I thought was a very interesting point.
Yeah, I found the boundary heightening, or what she calls sort of polarization phenomenon, interesting, because I think it speaks to what happens when more fundamental changes are attempted in an organization's culture, and you know, the resistance that can occur to that. So the presence of the token is seen as a threat because it changes something structural about how things operate in that context. And it made me think actually about the fact that I think this text is really getting at the importance of considering what needs to be changed at the structural level in organizations in order to achieve more balanced groups or some kind of equality. And in terms of the kind of modern, if you like, view of it, some of the ways that we tend to talk about managing difference or promoting difference now are very individualized. Certainly in the way we talk about diversity as an idea, Sometimes we talk about group differences, but very often it can mean that we talk about individual skills, individual ways that people are different from one another, you know, people's preferences as well as their needs or things like that. So this attention to structure I found really refreshing, actually, to go back and read.
And that's a good place to pause the conversation for part one. Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying the discussion thus far. If you are, we urge you to share the episode reading and the podcast with your friends, colleagues, and students. Also, if you feel inspired to contribute to the conversation, like our good friend and podcast guest, Deborah, has, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com and click on the podcast link to find out how you can help. We are always pleased to meet and hear from our listeners and learn what they find interesting. We are very grateful and honored that we have listeners in Denmark, Finland, Russia, Mexico, the Philippines, Argentina, the Netherlands, Canada, South Africa, Australia, United States, and the United Kingdom. Please check in next week for part two of our discussion of Some Effects of Proportions on Group Life by Rosabeth Moss Cantor. You won't want to miss this because the podcasters give more examples of Cantor's research applications. They will also spend time reviewing the implications of her research for diversity and organizational effectiveness. Here on Talking About Organizations.